Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. Wonderful show coming up. Our guest today is a member of the Marine Special Operations Command, a veteran. His very first book caused quite a stir, went straight to a New York Times bestseller. He's got a second book coming out. Stick around. You're going to want to hear from our guest today. But first, a little bit of history, as we usually start with. Happy birthday to the United States Air Force. On this date in 1947, the United States Air Force was established as a separate branch, and the Air National Guard was also created as a separate reserve component. Let me tell you about Arthur J. Jackson from Cleveland, Ohio. Jackson was a member of the Marine Corps 3rd Battalion, 7th Marine, 1st Marine Division. On September 18, 1944, while engaged in action against the Japanese on the island of Peleliu, his platoon's left flank was held up by fire from Japanese troops in strongly fortified positions. Taking the initiative and defying the heavy barrage of fire directed in his position, Private First Class Jackson charged towards a large pillbox housing approximately 35 enemy soldiers. Pouring automatic weapon fire into the installation's opening to pin down the enemy troops, he then hurled in white phosphorus grenades and explosive charges brought up to him by a fellow Marine, demolishing the pillbox and killing all the enemy inside. Advancing alone under continuous fire from other hostile emplacements, he employed similar means to smash through smaller positions in the immediate vicinity. Determined to crush the entire pocket of resistance all by himself, and although harassed on all sides by shattering blasts of Japanese weapons, he stormed one gun position after another, dealing death and destruction to the savagely fighting enemy in his drive against the remaining defenses. At the end of the day, he destroyed 12 pillboxes and killed 50 Japanese soldiers. Jackson would later be wounded on Peleliu and again on Okinawa. For his actions that day, Arthur J. Jackson, United States Marines, was awarded the Medal of Honor by President Harry Truman. In that same ceremony, Truman awarded the Medal of Honor to fighter ace Greg Pappy Boynton of the famed Black Sheep Squadron and the future Marine Corps Commandant Lewis Wilson. 67 years later, Jackson would be welcomed aboard to address the 1,000 sailors and Marines of the amphibious assault ship USS Peleliu. Ladies and gentlemen, as I mentioned, we've got a great guest today. You're going to really enjoy this. You know, his first book, Level Zero Heroes, has been called the Catch-22 of this generation. Our guest today on American Warrior Radio, we're very, very pleased to have him. Welcome, Michael Golombeski, if that's right. Michael?
No, you did it absolutely right, Ben. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. Do I call you Michael? Do I call you Ski? What do I call you?
Ben, you can just call me Ski.
Okay. I'll try and remember that. Well, Ski, thank you so much. I know this was short notice on your end, but I saw something in the Marine Corps Times about your second book, Dagger 22, coming out, and I thought, holy cow, let's get this guy on the show in time to promote that book. And, I mean, just some compelling stories, Ski. As you say, I think on Dagger 22, which is the follow-up novel, time to target is what?
Time to target right now is 3 days.
3 days. Folks can get it in their local bookstore or on Amazon or pretty much anywhere, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. Anywhere online, any bookstore.
Okay. Now, Michael, let's talk. I ask some dumb questions, and I don't know. That's maybe why people tune in, because the whole point of this show is to educate and inform civilians. Let's start off with, how on earth did a long-haired hippie with a peace tattoo go from working in a dairy in Colorado to the United States Marine Corps?
Well, first of all, Ben, there are no dumb questions, just dumb answers.
Okay.
Wow. I guess my road into the military was not well defined for me. I had, at the time that I joined the service, I was 26, so I was relatively old for going into the military. Never really planned on it. It wasn't a career field that I was even remotely interested in. It just happened, you know, one morning, just like many other Americans, I woke up on September 11th. I had been working all night driving tractor trailers for a dairy, and I had gotten a phone call, and it was from somebody back home saying, hey, do you see what's going on? And we didn't have television at the time in my apartment, so we had to go out and find a TV just in time to see the second airplane crash into the World Trade Center. And that kind of started my journey into the military. It was kind of one of those callings of the here and now, that this is an event that's going to change the course of history for America and also the Western world. And I just felt that I needed to be a part of it. in some capacity, and that capacity happened to be as a U.S. Marine.
You know, Michael, I think we need a name for that, for your generation and for your types of folks. So often I talk to guests or, a couple weeks ago, even some Border Patrol agents whose inspiration to join, to volunteer, was 9/11. There's a whole class of you out there, and particularly, you know, pretty close to the anniversary of September, the 15th anniversary of September 11th, that certainly strikes home. What now, Mike, was there something in particular about the Marines that fascinated you versus the other branches, or?
It was the only branch of service that I thought that I could go into, and I didn't want to, you know, have a kind of a sideline job, maybe doing supply or something like that. I wanted to go into the infantry. I was, you know, physically in shape. I was willing and able to go and, you know, carry a weapon. And I thought that going into the Marine Corps would give me my best chance to kind of get a frontline job, whatever that would be. I had no idea.
Okay, well, you got more than a frontline job, brother. I mean, you got MARSOC. For those folks out there listening who don't know, that is the Marine Corps Forces Special Operations Command, a relatively new command of the United States Marine Corps. What, describe for our listeners, we got about 2 minutes before the first break, Ski. Tell our listeners in, you know, Reader's Digest version, what does MARSOC do?
Okay, so MARSOC is the newest component to U.S. SOCOM, which is the big Special Operations Command. Everyone's really familiar with the Navy portion, so Navy SEALs, U.S. Special Forces, so U.S. Army, and then we also have a Special Forces Command from the Air Force. Well, up to about 2006, the Marine Corps did not have a component of Special Operations because that requirement was being filled by the Navy. So the Pentagon, in all their wisdom, says, hey, we need to get the U.S. Marines involved in this special operations thing because it's ballooning and it's just the capacity and the need for it is great. And the Marines have been doing a great thing with the straight leg infantry style. I guarantee you put them in special operations, they're going to excel because they're Marines and that's what they do. So now you have a portion of U.S. SOCOM, which is Marine Corps Special Operations Command. So now we're providing U.S. Marines and their talents and abilities into the special operations community.
Now, Ski, the Marines, it seems a little bit different. Well, I don't know if it's different or not, but I mean, there's several levels of discipline that then comprise the members of MARSOC as well, too, right?
Yes. So, just recently they have made a designated, military occupation specialty, which is for CSOs. So those are critical skills operators. They are actually trained, school evaluated and selected operators that now fill up these raider battalions is what they're called now. So yes, there's a lot of specialty, jobs within MARSOC, especially at the team level, because they operate as such small groups and they have to have a high capacity for operating on their own in austere environments and also having the capability and access to bring in large fire support.
Now, most Marines, Michael, I'm guessing, bring a lot of that capability to the table already. Is there a separate sort of is there a Marine equivalent of BUDS, if you will, or specialized training?
Yes, so they have assessment and selection for Marine Corps operators. The one thing that separates the Marine Corps special operations from the other branches is you cannot go to a recruiter and say, hey, I want to be a U.S. Marine in MARSOC. There's no pipeline for that. You have to be a Marine first, with one enlistment under your belt. So that right there weeds out a lot of people, and the people that are coming into it are already setting that mindset of accomplishment because they've already gone through boot camp. They're already a U.S. Marine. They've already done maybe one or two deployments under their belt. And now they're seasoned. Now they're saying, I want to take that next step and go into the Special Operations Command and go roll with those guys.
Okay. Michael Golombeski, our guest here today. We're going to talk a little bit about your books and the stories within the books. Folks, the books are Level Zero Heroes and the upcoming Dagger 22. Again, our guest is MARSOC veteran Michael Golombeski. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Those Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. Our guest today, Staff Sergeant Michael Golombeski, or also just Ski. Michael has got, I think, Mike, you said 8 years service in the Marines?
Yes, just over 8 years, starting in 2002 and getting out towards the end of 2010.
Okay, and you had deployments to both Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yes, I had the lovely pleasure of going to both of those countries.
The vacation hotspots of the free world. And you served with the MARSOC, Marine Corps Special Forces Special Operations Command. But beyond that, you also were a forward observer, a JTAC. Explain to our listeners what the role of the JTAC is. We talked a little before the break about those specialties within MARSOC, and this is a very specialized role as well, correct?
Yes. So JTAC stands for Joint Terminal Attack Controller. What that is anytime there's a piece of ordnance or anything that comes off of an aircraft, bombs, somebody's got to be in control of it. Designating the target and giving the situation updates on the ground. So ground controllers and JTACs, their primary responsibility is to link the ground forces, which in my case was my team, with any air asset that we had. So anything from a unmanned aircraft all the way up to a B-1 Lancer. I was the link between the team and those assets. And my job was to work hand in hand with my team leader, Andy, and facilitate those aircrafts. If he needed a bomb somewhere or a gun run, it was my responsibility to get that executed for them.
Now, would you also be calling in those orders for other teams in the vicinity, not necessarily your team specifically, but maybe an allied team or maybe some Navy SEALs?
Yes, absolutely. So when we first got to our region of Afghanistan, I was the only – the thing with JTACs is they are qualified across the board. They can work with any branch of service, any aircraft, any NATO aircraft. So they're in high demand. It just happened to be that where we were at that time, there were no other JTACs in the valley, but there were other units. There were Italian units. There were 82nd Airborne units. They didn't have a JTAC. Well, when things start getting rough and we're getting in the fight, I can help out anybody.
At least that's the way it's supposed to work.
Yes. On paper, that's how it's supposed to work.
Well, and folks, I encourage you to get the book Level Zero Heroes, and then his upcoming follow-up book, Dagger 22, will be released here in 3 days from today. And Ski, except one reviewer has called this the Catch 22 for this generation. If folks aren't familiar with Joseph Heller's novel, it was based in World War II, and it included what was often called the double bind, where basically you weren't allowed to fly missions if you were crazy, but anyone who said, I'm crazy, I don't want to fly the mission, therefore was rational and wouldn't have to fly the mission. And the whole idea of Catch-22 has worked its way into our English lexicon. Tell us about what the rules of engagement were supposed to be when you arrived in Afghanistan.
So the rules of engagement, it's kind of a... it's an evolving thing consistently and constantly. A lot of it has to do with when you have big, high level command changes, say for the commander of Afghanistan, when they rotate out, and even with some of the lower level commanders, what you have is you have an environment where commanders want to make their mark on the war and be able to say that this was my effort, this is what I did. It just happened to be that when we were there, the commander of ISAF forces was General McChrystal, Stanley McChrystal. Starting off with our rules of engagements were pretty restrictive on what we could do, but along the same lines is this is what we trained to do, especially as an aircraft controller. I'm always constantly thinking about and calculating for, are there going to be civilian casualties? Is this bomb going to destroy, more than is needed? Those are things that we take into account because this is what we are trained to do. Now, with the politics of it kind of seeping into the military side, we've got a lot of other injectors on the battlefield that we have to deal with other than the enemy shooting at us. Now we've got to worry about, are we doing this correctly? If I do this, am I going to have to answer to somebody? So it came to, we were not allowed to drop any type of ordnance on a building. So that became extremely restrictive to us, where the only way that we could get approval to do that is we would have to be in absolute dire straits. We would have to get to the point where we are starting to lose guys. Now I have the authority or gotten permission to drop ordnance. Later in the deployment, it got to the point where they said, okay, we're entering a new phase, and now you're not allowed to do any raids at night. We don't want any night raids going on around the country. So that restricts our movement and our ability to, you know, shape the fight, because, you know, we own the night.
Right.
And now you're telling us we can't go in and do raids at night. We got to do them during the day when everybody sees us.
And while you were in country, how many times did these rules change?
Oh, I would say at least with major changes, probably about 4 or 5.
Wow. Okay.
And they evolve and become more and more restrictive, to the point where it almost becomes a joke of, okay, well, what are they going to restrict us to do now? You know, they're going to limit us to one magazine of ammo each, so we don't shoot too much.
Mm. Wow. Okay. Well, I tell you, let's get into the stories, if you don't mind, Ski, because I get the sense that you loved your job.
Oh, I absolutely loved it. It was nothing short of a honor and a privilege to operate and work alongside some of these guys.
Okay, but just like anyone who wields or has control over a weapon, you also had a huge responsibility for directing those airborne munitions.
Yeah.
I mean, and the consequences thereof.
Yes, because, you know, if I'm a ground controller and I'm talking to an aircraft, and we've gone through the process of saying, okay, we're going to put this 500-pounder on this building for these reasons, as soon as that bomb is released from that aircraft wing, it has my name on it as a controller, because I'm the one that cleared that ordnance hot. So I had to, you know, take every precaution, every aspect of the situation or the scenario that we're in. I have to take into account for everything, because as soon as it comes off the rail, I own it.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask you, we got about a minute and a half. I'm going to ask you to acquaint the listeners with the Bala Mergab region when we come back after the break. But first of all, let's start off with, I'm guessing your second, and I've read that basically that this story was too large for just two books, hence the upcoming Dagger 22. But if I'm not wrong, Ski, Dagger 22 refers to your Special Operations Team 8222, correct?
Yes, Dagger 22 is the call sign of our team that we operated in Northwest Afghanistan. And you're exactly right, with the two books, it is just a continuation of one story. These two books represent the entire story of the team, because in the process of writing the first book, you know, we were limited to about 110,000 words. We got to about 60,000 words, and it's like, wow, this is not going to fit. We're like 2 weeks into the story, and we're at 60,000 words. So the choice came very clear to find a natural pause in the story, and we'll just cut the story right there. And if people are interested and the publisher wants to publish the other half of it, we can do that. But each book stands alone and has closure and beginning and references and kind of character development. So you can read Dagger 22 when it comes out and still go back and read the first one, but they are self-contained stories unto themselves.
Forget about that, folks. Get Level Zero Heroes first, read it, and then buy Dagger 22. How's that, Ski? Okay, folks, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Stick around. We're talking about MARSOC and just some really compelling books. The first, a New York Times bestseller. Our guest, Michael Golombieski, will be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined on the phone by Michael Golombieski. Michael Golombieski, what'd you call him, Ski? He's got two books out. His first book, Level Zero Heroes, became a national bestseller. His follow-up book, Dagger 22, is coming out in 3 days. Folks, you heard the ad. for Charles' sake. That means our survey says, sir, yes, sir, question of the day line is open. The very first caller, not second, not third, we play for keeps here. The first caller gets a $20 gift card to Charo's Steak downtown. Ski, back to you. You know, I was just thinking about it during the commercial break. It's taking you two books to tell this story, and I'm planning to do it on 22 minutes here, so I guess we should probably pick up the pace, huh?
Let's do it.
That's right. Tell a Marine. Let's do it. So the Bala, correct me if I'm wrong here, Bala Mergab, is that how
there
it's pronounced?
Go. Bala Mergab.
Okay, that was sort of a not a resort, but that's kind of where the Taliban went to rest and recuperate, right? They had pretty much full control of that area. They would hang out during the winters and just not do much.
Yes, absolutely, just kind of a rest and refit area. You look at when our team, when the team that I was on got there in 2009, in 2008, prior to that is when the first U.S. NATO forces actually visited the valley and set up, at the time, the Spanish were the first to settle there, at Bab Columbus. Up to that point, you know, we're talking 2008. The war had been going on for years and years, and here we are in 2008. Now the first presence of NATO troops, in the valley, because it wasn't considered a strategic area or an area of great importance, because we're talking about northwestern Afghanistan.
Okay.
Up by the Turkmenistan border, kind of close to Herat. Herat City would be the large city nearest to it, but the main focus was on that, you know, that valley territory between Pakistan and Afghanistan. That was the main hot spot. And then around your big districts like Kandahar and Kabul. So the Bala Mergab River Valley was really just a non-player, where there were no ISAF forces or NATO forces, because it was just so remote. And those types of places become great places for the winter to bed down. You don't have to worry about patrols coming through, surveillance and things like that. So it becomes a kind of a winter retreat where you can just relax and kind of think about what are we going to do as the insurgency for next year.
A winter retreat for the bad guys. I want to clarify that.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that all changed, if I'm not mistaken, Ski, with an incident involving some 82nd Airborne troops. Is that accurate? Is that what sort of refocused the attention on that area?
Yes. The Spanish were first there at Bab Columbus. They decided they didn't like that and didn't want to be there, so they handed it over to the Italian and also the 82nd Airborne. So they move up there, they take over, and the place is, you know, like 70 kilometers from the nearest thing that you would refer to as a city. One road in, if you want to call it a road, but there was one road in and out. Everything else had to come in by helicopters. And being in a valley in a mountain region, you can kind of understand the weather in that area. So very not dependent on or reliable on aircraft assets. We lived on airdrops. So we're talking about a very remote area. Unfortunately, the first day that we were there after a five-day convoy to get out to the forward operating base, they had an airdrop come in around noon. Unfortunately, those pallets came off and they were blown off course. So at this time, the security posture around the FOB was extremely small. If you even want to call it a safe area, it was just the FOB and directly across the river where there were some local government agencies there. So you have your district governor and things like that. Very tiny area that was considered secure. Everything else was Taliban owned, and they didn't like anybody coming and walking in their areas. So the airdrop goes off. Some of the pallets are blown off course. A few fall into the river, the Bala Mergab River, which, you know, when you think of a river, you think of, you know, nice flowing flat, but this is more like a jagged, rocky type of river bottom, very turbulent, very muddy and boggy, mm-hmm. fast moving. So pallets go out across the field into the Taliban controlled territory. Some land in the water, and this is our lifeline. This is what we live off of up there. So these are valuable items. 82nd Airborne soldier goes into the river, full gear, weapon, everything. tries to grab onto one of the parachute strings, ends up stepping off of a ledge, in the river. So goes from, you know, hip high to, you know, 30 feet deep, falls in, goes under. His sergeant, goes in after him, full gear, everything else. He ends up going under too. Now we've got two missing 82nd Airborne soldiers because they go under and they don't come up.
So, and as anybody who listens to this program or pays attention at all knows, we don't leave men behind. So I'm guessing there's a rescue or eventually turn into a recovery mission for these two 82nd Airborne?
Yes, absolutely. That is a promise that is made to each of us as a service member that dead or alive, you come home. Either way, you will come home.
Well, I was just going to say, in the process of that, if I'm getting this correctly, then this is what led to some of the other battles. And this went from just recovering, not just recovering, but from a recovery mission to a series of full-fledged knock-em-in-the-nose fights, right?
Yes, because up to that point, the Taliban in the region didn't have a lot of conflict with the small base that was there because they just didn't have the manpower and assets to go out to the valley. Well, when this happened, this became a tier one event. So now they're pushing aircraft up to us. They are bringing in additional forces. And the Taliban at the time did not know that we had lost those two soldiers. They perceived it as a like an offensive, like a clearing offensive, bringing in all these additional troops. So that kind of put them off to what we were doing. So that started the skirmishes. And then once the skirmishes started, then it became more of a, we had to secure a long stretch of the river to be able to search and recover our soldiers. So they perceived it as us spreading out into the valley, and they weren't too receptive to that.
Now, Ski, Tucson, for our local listeners here in Tucson, this Davis-Monthan is the headquarters training base for the A-10. We just love that aircraft. In one of these early skirmishes, there was an incident that is pretty sad where fire support was called in with an A-10, and it turned out to be the wrong target coordinates, correct?
Yes, that very unfortunate. It was a clearing operation that was happening in the southeast portion of the Bazaar Market area. And it's one of those fogs of war. We train for it not to happen, especially as controllers. But when you're in these bare knuckle fights and the enemy's elusive, they're moving, you're going from, you know, compound to compound, wall over wall, and you start getting in these built up areas, becomes very easy to become disoriented. And unfortunately, what the controller on the ground was seeing was not exactly what the pilot was seeing. And, unfortunately, the aircraft rolled in and did a gun run on a friendly position.
Now, and I mentioned that now that you did not, this was not one of your runs, correct? You didn't call this one in yourself.
Negative.
Okay. So, but I mentioned that because it has a critical, it's a defining moment in what happens later on in the actions in the books. And we'll talk about that here when we come back with Michael Golombisky. Michael, while we're on the break, think about something, because, again, as a civilian, here's another one of those dumb questions. Please tell me that we're not wasting hard points on our aircraft on a bomb that doesn't have the full boom. When we come back, I want you to tell me what in the heck is a warning bomb. Folks, your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. Stick around. We'll be right back.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. We're joined by Michael Golombisky, Ski, if you will. Michael is a 8-year Marine veteran, several of those years, a couple of tours of duty with the Marine MARSOC. His team was Dagger 22, and we're talking about the Bala Mergab region. Ski, back to you. In reading the book, and I encourage folks, ladies and gentlemen, these are just these are compelling reads, but they're easy reads, if that makes sense. Level Zero Heroes and the upcoming Catch-22. You can find out more by checking out levelzeroheroes.com. Ski, there's a you're up there. You're in a position. I don't know if it's up or down or left or right, but you see friendly forces engaged, lots of bad guys in this valley. You're in a position to do something about it with, in some cases, maybe just one airstrike. But somewhere you talk about someone saying, drop a warning bomb. Excuse me? What on earth is a warning bomb?
I asked the same thing when I was told that over the radio. We were in a position on a hill. We were actually being pinned down by fire. So we are on the receiving end of this gunfire. And unfortunately, or in some cases, probably fortunately, we were assigned to the 82nd Airborne to help support them in this operation, to help seize this hilltop. So we were taking guidance and we're getting permission to drop ordnance from their commander. We want to try to de-escalate as best we can, but there comes a point where you just have to dominate the fight. You just have to unload with huge amounts of firepower and just gain control of the situation.
Right.
What had happened is we had identified two or three compounds within this village. Okay, we know we got machine gun fire coming from here. We've got people over here. I'm talking to my team leader, Andy. You know, I've got grids made up. I've got a B-1 bomber just checked on station, and I can get up a grid. We can put a piece of ordnance on this and just squash this whole thing right now. So he gets on the radio. He's talking over to the 82nd Airborne Command Center, and their commander, his thinking was, I guess it was, he didn't want to escalate that quickly to just start dropping bombs in the village. So, you know, he suggested or told us that we could drop a warning bomb, which I had never heard before. I'm glad I'm not the only one. Yeah, I didn't know we made 500 pounders or 2000 pound bombs just to kind of show off. They're usually used for very precise things. So they said, no, we can't drop it in the village, but I could give them a grid to a hillside that's outside of the village, and we'll drop it, and then we'll let them know that we mean business. Either that, or me personally, I see it being perceived by the enemy as, hey, they can't hit us. They totally missed us.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's all I was given on what I could do. So I said, okay. So I drop it. Bomb goes off. Actually, the first one. This is kind of funny. The first one was actually a dud, didn't detonate. So I had immediately had the bomber come around, hit the same grid coordinates. 500 pounder goes off. The enemy gets a little scared. They go dormant for about 5 minutes, and then they peek their heads back up. Hey, they hit the hillside. So they start shooting again at us. Now I have more of a reason to get back on the radio and say, hey, this is not working. Okay. I see the enemy. I've got the grid. We've got to do this.
Now, is this the battle? At what point you describe a battle where I think it was a medic. There was a casualty. He went out to help the casualty. He was shot. So, I mean, not only do you have friendly troops in contact, but you're losing, in this case, soldiers, correct?
Oh, we were on top of that hilltop, which this is the battle for Pathfinder Hill. Which is in the first book, Level Zero Heroes. This went on for about 2 or 3 days that we were on that hilltop in between different skirmishes, and it had gotten to the one point where they tried to flank us on the hillside, and they basically got an elevated position and were able to unload automatic gunfire almost directly into the trenches that we had built. One of the rounds had caught my fellow team member, Mikey, right in the helmet. Fortunately, it didn't penetrate his skull. It just went through the helmet and kind of did a halo around it. A lot of bleeding, but, you know, he had his bell rung, but he wasn't injured that severely.
No.
Another round had caught our sniper right in the middle of his rifle, right in the magazine well, had knocked him off the weapon. So we were in a pinned down situation.
Now, Ski, I'm guessing the reason there are people like you, the JTACs, and the folks actually on the ground with eyes on the situation is so that you are able to say, no, we need this here now, not over there. At some point in that kind of a situation, you know, coming back to the Catch-22 reference again, do you just say, forget about it, I'm directing the ordinance where it needs to go, and I'll pay the consequences later?
The decision to actually do it would come from my team leader, and I had a great relationship with Andy, and we were on the same page, okay? We will do our best to, you know, call in over the radio or over SATCOM and say, hey, this is what we're about to do. Can we get authority? But when we're pinned down and we're in contact and we're in a, you know, knuckle on knuckle fight, it's Andy's, the delegation of responsibility gets pushed down to Andy as the team leader. And now it's me talking to Andy and having a conversation, a very quick conversation about, hey, this is what we need to do. He gives me the okay. And then I execute it. But, you know, we're taking into account all these things, that the rules of engagement are, you know, in letter law being pushed on to us as controllers. We don't want any harm to come to any civilian. That's
sure.
That's the furthest thing. We only destroy what's needed. And I had a great relationship with my team leader, and I was able to give him the information that he needs to make that timely decision, and that, we dropped a lot of bombs.
Okay, now, you know, and I'm certainly not encouraging a break in the order of discipline. I mean, that's one of the key things that makes the military work. But in this case, I mean, you're basically calling in fire support on for yourself, for your own position, correct?
Yes.
Okay, well, that, at least in my mind, that's a different story. Now, I brought up the issue with the A-10 because later on there was a situation where you called in some ordnance and describe this for me real quickly. Later on, there's a truck that comes out of the village. The bad guys, the Taliban, say, look, here's a dead woman and the child that was killed by your bomb, which is probably the worst case scenario for you. I mean, other than you know, dropping a bomb on your own head, is probably one of the worst case scenarios for someone like you, correct, Ski?
Yeah. To this day, I still remember that because we had been fighting for almost 3 or 4 days, and I had dropped quite a few pieces of ordnance in this village. To see that when they brought those two out, they tried to say that it was an ordnance that had done it. We come to find out later on that no, they were both shot from behind with the AK-47 round. So, but just when that situation was unveiling, I was on the hill looking through my binos when the vehicle came in. The guys on security went up there, stopped the vehicle, got the men out, and then, you know, through my binos, I see this small person be carried out of the back and laid on the ground, and then another large one, and my heart just sunk into my stomach, because that is not what, you know, us as warriors, women and children, they're off limits. They're sacred, and we protect them, along with the innocents.
And, you know, that's why I specifically brought up that situation, because not only is it a testament to the quality and the character of our men and women in the uniform, but it also talks to how awful, how depraved these groups that we're fighting over there are. I mean, they basically assassinated a woman and child for propaganda purposes.
Yes, they were being used as a tool for the fighters that were stuck in the village to get out because they couldn't escape because we had it completely sectioned off. So we had snipers on the boundaries, so they couldn't run out. They couldn't sneak out even at night with our illumination rounds and our night vision. They weren't getting out. And after, you know, 3 or 4 days stuck in a village that's just getting hammered by ordnance and, small arms fire, they saw this as a way out. They could, you know, just say that they were, trapped in the village and, you know, kind of worm their way out saying, hey, we know we're just trying to get out of the area. When, you know, we looked at the three guys sitting on the ground that were in the vehicle coming out, you could tell they were Taliban up and down.
Yeah.
But command was telling us, hey, let them go out, and that was, you know, one of those situations where you just throw your hands up, and it's like, why are we here?
Frustrating. frustrating. Well, I tell you, Mike, we've got about just about a minute and a half left. I want to get to something, though, real quick that's in the news now. Folks, the books are Level Zero Heroes and the upcoming Dagger 22. You can get more information by visiting levelzeroheroes.com or just check it out on Amazon. Real quick, Mike, we got about 30, 45 seconds. One of the main groups that you support is the MARSOC Foundation. There was a run yesterday, I think, the Semper Fi run to raise money for the MARSOC Foundation, and there was a bomb that went off. Any quick thoughts on that?
Yes, that was the one in Seaside Heights in Jersey. I was actually invited to come speak at the prayer breakfast there for that event. Unfortunately, I couldn't make it, but, you know, I'm hearing this stuff or seeing this stuff online, between that and then what's happened up here in New York City. This is stuff that we would used to see on the news happening in other.
Yeah.
That can't get their act together.
Yeah. Mike, thanks so much. Stick around. We've got to go to break. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia. Tune in next week, AmericanWarriorRadio.com.